From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show, connecting your neighborhood with the world. Later in the broadcast, Below the Beltway, the comic collaboration of Gene Weingarten and Eric Shansby enters the new territory of children's books. But first, Congress and the threats posed to the United States by Islamic extremists far outside the Beltway. Congress is currently debating how to authorize the use of military force in U.S. efforts to combat the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. U.S. Senator Tim Kaine offered up a proposal this week that would allow for airstrikes and for support to flow to moderate Syrian rebels, but it would limit the use of U.S. ground forces in these countries to rescue missions, and the authorization would sunset after a year. Joining us to explore what he sees at stake in this part of the world and what he sees at stake and how Congress crafts a response to it is U.S. Senator Tim Kaine. He's a Democrat from Virginia. He joins us from studios at the U.S. Capitol. Senator Kaine, thank you for joining us.
You bet, Kojo. Good to be with you today.
If you have questions or comments for Senator Tim Kaine, give us a call at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. You wrote in the New York Times yesterday that the current threat the Islamic State poses to the United States not only is a challenge to our security, but the process of combating that threat can be an opportunity to rebalance our constitutional principles. First, what is the current threat that ISIL, in your view, poses to the U.S.?
Kojo, I think the ISIL threat, as evidenced by their gobbling up of territory, their horrific practices against women, religious minorities, their beheading of American journalists and British aid workers, they are a barbaric and violent extremist group, and they are also extremely well-funded now, knocking over banks and selling oil to get revenue, and they pose a significant threat to, obviously, people in the region, other nations, both immediate neighbors and European nations, and they also pose a threat to the United States. I think the threat is a very significant one. I don't think it's imminent. They're not going to attack the United States tomorrow, but they clearly have designs to hurt Americans, and they'll do it if they can, and they're rapidly gaining the capacity to do so.
How does the proposal you offer the opportunity to rebalance our constitutional principles?
You know, there are two really important issues here, Kojo. One is how we make the decision to initiate military action, and the second is what action should be authorized against ISIL. The president, in his speech last Wednesday to the nation, laid out, here's what we should do about ISIL, four basic pillars: humanitarian aid, airstrikes, counterterrorism operations, and then arming ground forces in the region to include the Iraqi security forces, Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, and moderates in Syria. And those, I think those are reasonable pillars. But the president also said he believes he has the authority to do that without congressional approval. And I drastically disagree with the president on that. The president's power with respect to war is pretty clearly elaborated in Article 2 of the Constitution, and it's been understood since the framers drafted it to be a power of defense. The president can act to defend the nation from an imminent or actual attack. But the president really can't go on offense without Congress. Presidents since Thomas Jefferson have recognized that. Senator Obama recognized it as a candidate for president. And when he said 2 weeks ago on Meet the Press, it's time to go on offense against ISIL, that's where the need for congressional authority kicks in. Many of my colleagues in Congress were willing to grant the president that unilateral power. I'm not. And so I've drafted a proposal to authorize force along the lines the president suggested, but that also includes some key limitations, and I'm urging my colleagues that we need to take this up here in Congress.
In case you're just joining us, our guest is U.S. Senator Tim Kaine. He is a Democrat from Virginia. We're inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Senator Kaine, where do you see the key difference between what the president did in August when he authorized airstrikes and what he said he wanted to do last week when he addressed the country? Is there a significant difference between defense and offense in that situation?
Kojo, sometimes that the line can be a little bit fuzzy. When the president authorized airstrikes on the 8th of August, Congress was in recess. ISIL was moving with some momentum even toward Baghdad, where the U.S. has an embassy presence. The president has the ability unilaterally to protect the embassy. We have consular officials in Erbil in the Kurdish area of Iraq. And so he took initial steps that I think could fairly be characterized as defensive in nature. But at some point, the airstrike campaign started to change a bit. We acted to enable Iraqi ground forces to retake a dam in Mosul. There was no intelligence suggesting that that dam was going to be blown up, and even if it would have been, it was hundreds of miles away from U.S. personnel. At that point, the airstrike started to be really, I think, part of a broader campaign to go on offense against ISIL, and that's what the president, in fact, said. Many of my I have actually been saying since May of 2013, I don't think there is any current legal authority, particularly the authorizations crafted by Congress in 2001 and 2002, that would allow America to engage in military action in Syria without additional congressional authorization. When the president spoke last Wednesday, a number of my colleagues have now joined me in that, notably the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Menendez, who said, okay, I heard what the president said about the mission. This is not a narrow defensive mission of short time duration. It's a long-term offensive mission against ISIL, and for that, you've got to have congressional approval. And I think most in Congress are coming to that conclusion, and I think we will work in a bipartisan way with the president to provide a limited authority, but it has to be something that Congress is involved in. We shouldn't abdicate that responsibility and allow a unilateral executive to move forward, because if we do, we will set a precedent for future operations, and I think it'll be a precedent that we will regret.
Just to be clear here, Senator Kaine, you seem to be saying that on the merits of the case the president made, you agree that it's necessary to begin a more offensive phase in that part of the world in general or against ISIL in particular.
I do. This is, you know, it's interesting, Kojo. I guess being a Virginian, you're always prone to cite Virginia examples. But when Thomas Jefferson was president, he was in the region fighting against, you know, confronting a terrorist organization of the day, the Barbary pirates that were interrupting American shipping in the Mediterranean, both the commercial and military shipping. He had the power as commander in chief to order his Navy to repel attacks once they started. He could do that all day long without Congress. But at some point he said, just repelling repeated attacks is not the right strategy. I need to go on offense and try to reduce this threat so we don't have to repel attacks. At that point he said, if I'm going on offense, I've got to have Congress to do it. But I do think the president's basic pillars, the four pillars he outlined, are important. I support them. The authorization I've drafted authorizes them, but with some critical limitations. For example, no ground troops. Some of the limitations are things that the president stated in his speech, but other limitations I've included are limitations, frankly, lessons learned from 13 years of operating.
I was about
under
to
two
say,
authorizations.
What do you say are those painful lessons that we have learned in the wake of the military authorization enacted in the wake of the September 11th, 2001 attacks?
Let me give you three that are reflected in the authorization I've drafted. The authorization crafted after 9/11 didn't have a geographic or temporal limitation on it. And so we are still fighting under a 2001 authorization in many places in the world. And it concerns me greatly that administration officials have said, well, this authorization probably will enable us to continue to be at war for the next 25 years. I don't think that's what Congress intended when they voted on N01. So I've put a geographic limitation in my authorization, Syria and Iraq, and I've put a temporal limitation. The authorization would expire after 1 year unless Congress extends it. A second limitation, the administrations, both Bush and Obama administrations, took the language from the 01 authorization, enabling action against those who perpetrated the 9/11 attacks, and created a separate category administratively. We could also go after the perpetrators, al-Qaeda, or, quote, associated forces. The administrative definition of associated forces has been so broad as to basically encompass almost anyone. And so in my authorization, I have a very narrow definition of who we are authorizing to be the target of military action, so that it doesn't morph and extend and become some kind of an all-purpose authority to go after anyone. And then third, I proposed the repeal of the 2002 Iraq authorization in my bill that I introduced yesterday, because I don't think we should have sort of dueling or repetitive or overlapping Iraq authorizations out there, and it's time to repeal the 2002 Iraq authorization. That was drafted to get rid of the Saddam Hussein government. They've been long gone, and we need to repeal that so that it's not used in a way that Congress never would have intended.
Allow me to go to the telephones. We'll start with Michael in Lake Ridge, Virginia. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you. My concern is that this appears to be an authorization to declare war in Syria and take military action against the Syrian government. Comments made by President Obama and also by Secretary Kerry yesterday and the day before both talked about attacking the Syrian government and the Syrian army. And the moderate rebels said they're going to team up with ISIL to attack the Syrian government. So, and these 5,000 moderates trained in Saudi Arabia aren't going to be ready for a year. So I'm concerned that this is a way that President Obama is going to attack Syria without going to declare war in Syria.
Senator Kaine, how would your proposal limit what the president is able to do?
There is absolutely nothing in this authorization that would allow attack against the Syrian government. That's not what this is about. It is clearly focused on attacking ISIL. And I was at the hearing with Secretary Kerry yesterday, and he made that plain as well, that there are members on the Foreign Relations Committee who would like to be able to arm folks to also wage action against the Syrian regime. And they were pressing Senator Kerry, shouldn't they be able to go after the government of Bashar al-Assad? But Secretary Kerry was very plain about this. No, this is an effort that is against ISIL. My authorization makes that plain. And there are actually, Kojo, some other senators have introduced authorizations as well with similar limitations. I will say to the caller's maybe broader point, the situation in Syria is much more complicated than in Iraq. Providing assistance to the Iraqi security forces and the Peshmerga in the Kurdish area, we have a very strong track record of working together with them. The situation in Syria is more difficult, and I think progress will be more difficult. But if we are trying to focus our energies on the defeat of ISIL, they use Syria as their basic HQ. They've erased the border, and if we confined our activities just to one side of the line, they would retract behind that border and continue to wreak havoc on Syrians and others.
You mentioned that the situation in Syria is difficult and complicated. What concerns do you have about our ability to identify and empower the rebels that it is in the U.S.'s interest to support? Some people have described the messiness that's developed in Syria as the bug magnet that's attracting extreme elements both in Syria and Iraq.
There are extreme elements that are coming into Syria to support Bashar al-Assad, Hezbollah, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. There are extreme elements coming into Syria to oppose Bashar al-Assad. It is very, very difficult. But the U.S. and other nations have been working on this for about the last year, and there's some significant experience now in recognizing which groups, we talk about moderate opposition, frankly, which groups will effectively battle against this ISIL threat. And Koji, let me just say, why do anything in Syria at all? This is linked to the no ground troop limitation that's important, no U.S. ground troop limitation. We need to see the region and people of the region standing up against this ISIL extremist violence threat. And if they do, the U.S. and Western nations, who also have something at stake, should be supporters and allies. But it can't be a U.S. or Western campaign against ISIL. And so supporting the people of the region, whether it's, again, the Kurds or Iraqis or Syrians, who take the ISIL extremist threat seriously and want to defeat it, is what we should do. And what we can do, and U.S. ground troops, there's no amount of U.S. ground troops that would be sufficient to do this if it is not the region itself standing up against this extremist threat. I guess the way to summarize is that the U.S. can't police a region that won't police itself. There are significant regional players both in Iraq and Syria and in the neighborhood, coming forward to say, we need to stand up against this existential threat, and I think it's important that we support them.
One more question. It comes from Greg in Washington, D.C. You introduced this bill along with Senator John McCain of Arizona. Greg in Washington, I think, wants to know, well, Greg, speak for yourself, how far this bipartisanship will go.
Yeah, I'm quite interested. Hi, Senator Tim Kaine.
Hey, John.
Longtime fan from Virginia. This is Greg Poirier.
Fantastic.
I appreciate your leadership once again, you know, trying to help embed new rules in the engagement game in the 21st century. I'm not sure. I personally am comfortable with ignoring political boundaries, whether we like Syrians or, you know, whether we want to work with the Assad regime. But do you think this bipartisanship will continue into something substantial, or will it just be kind of made into more political fodder the way things tend to go these days in Washington?
Well, good question. And actually, Greg, so there's three related efforts going on right now that just indicate how complicated the world is. The first is trying to craft a narrow authorization with respect to the president's proposed action against ISIL. And Senator McCain and I and others are working together on that. We all share the view that Congress needs to be involved, that there needs to be an authorization. We have some minor differences of opinion about how we draft it, but I think Senator Menendez will lead us in a process that will work that out. Second, there is a bipartisan agreement in the Senate that we need to take the 2001 authorization passed in the days after 9/11 and significantly refine and narrow it. President Obama called for that in a speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013. Senators McCain and I and others are working on that. The third is a bill that Senator McCain and I introduced, which is to repeal the War Powers Act of 1973, which has proven unworkable to presidents and congresses of both parties in the 41 years since it passed, and replace it with a version that we think is more workable. And our version does basically three things. It defines what war is to trigger consultation and voting requirements. That may seem obvious, but when the framers drafted the Constitution, it was states versus states. Now we're dealing with non-state actors, drones, cyber threats, so some functional definition of what is war in the 21st century. Second, we create a consultation mechanism so that when a president says, I've consulted with Congress, we all know exactly what that means, and we can tell whether the president has in fact done it or not. And third, we create voting requirements so that members of Congress can't dodge their responsibilities. People sometimes complain about wars being started by imperial presidents of all parties going back to the 1780s, but it's equally the case that Congress often wants to avoid their responsibility to cast these kinds of tough votes and let the president act only to criticize later. John McCain and I think Congress needs to be on the board before we initiate military action. Our servicemen and women deserve that degree of debate and effort to find consensus before we ask them to risk their lives.
Greg, thank you very much for your call. Tim Kaine is a member of the United States Senate. He's a Democrat from Virginia. Senator Kaine, thank you for joining us.
You bet, Kojo. Good to be with you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Below the Beltway, the comic collaboration of Gene Weingarten and Eric Shansby enters the new territory of children's books. I'm Kojo Nandi. Writer Gene Weingarten and illustrator Eric Shansby have been partnering on the Below the Beltway humor column, read by about a million people a week in this region and beyond each week, for a decade. And now they're charting new waters, releasing a children's book, Me and Dog, about a kid named Sid and his adoring dog, Murphy. A simple, sweet story that also asks some big questions about who exactly is in charge around here. Joining us to talk about Sid and about their collaborative process is Gene Weingarten, author of the new children's book, Me and Dog. He's also the columnist behind Below the Beltway and as a Pulitzer Prize winning alleged staff member, staff writer at the Washington Post. I say alleged staff writer because I think he is subversive and sneaks his way into the Washington Post. But he's certainly here in person today. Gene, good to see you again.
Good to be back here.
Eric Shansby also joins us in studio. He is the illustrator of Me and Dog and the Below the Beltway column. Eric Shansby, good to meet you.
Great to meet you, Kojo.
If you have questions either for Gene Weingarten or Eric Shansby, give us a call at 800-433-8850. Before we get to the new kid's book, let's talk about your collaboration on Below the Beltway. How did you two come to work together?
We started in a very atypical way. I went to talk to a high school class what was your school, Eric?
Montgomery Blair
High School.
Like that school.
Yeah. And I was just talking to the journalism students there. And, it was a pretty ordinary half-hour presentation. And afterwards, this very, very young-looking guy came up to me. I don't know, if you look at Eric here, he probably looks to be about 23 or so.
Yes.
Eric's 29.
Oh.
So when Eric was 17, Eric looked 12. and so this 12-year-old came up to me with a packet of papers. They were basically political cartoons he had done, and he could barely meet my eyes. He was looking at the floor, and he asked me if I could take a look at this packet of papers, and I didn't really look at it until I got home, and it was just brilliantly drawn political cartooning. But he was so vague about this that I didn't even know who he was. His name wasn't on it. I had to get back to the school to try to figure out who this little genius was. That's how we met.
Eric, when you were 17 years old, you're meeting a guy who is already a famous columnist. You hand him. How seriously did you expect he would take your cartoons?
Oh, I didn't expect him to read them at all. I walked up to him and I handed him the latest school paper that had just come out. And because I had just become the art editor, rather than being organized enough to delegate all the different illustrations, I ended up doing them all myself on the night before the paper came out, obviously. And I gave it to him, and he said, "Well, I don't really have time to look at this now." And to me, that meant, thanks, I'll be
never
recycling this. But he emailed me a few weeks later.
Gene, did you have any reservations selecting a relatively young and untrained cartoonist, or was that part of the appeal of working with Eric?
It was part of the appeal. He hadn't learned any bad habits yet, really. It worked out well almost from the beginning, although we work, you know the term creative tension? We kind of surpass that. We work through creative hostility.
I was just about to ask you what your collaboration process is like.
Yeah, it's constant fighting. You know, I initially, one of the things that I thought would be great about working with essentially a kid is that he would be in awe of me and do whatever I wanted him to do.
Yeah, that's what I used to think with this production staff too, but it's exactly not working out that way.
Exactly. And what happened, the very first interview he gave about this new collaboration, I forget with who it was, who he gave it to, but his comment about working with me and my column is that he considered my column to be a long, tedious caption to his cartoon. And at that point, I realized this was going to be a fight.
You're not overly impressed with his writing, Eric?
No, I'm extremely impressed with his writing. Really, I'm just reacting to his own personal hostility towards me. And so my defense mechanism is to lash out.
And so there's this creative hostility, and it's been working out for you too so
far?
Oh,
it works great, I think. You can ask Gene if he agrees. I don't really know.
Well, Gene, images can often convey a joke in way words cannot. How important was it that your senses of humor aligned, or at least are complementary?
Yeah, they align pretty well, actually. We're both very seditious, and it kind of comes out. But the process, the process can be painful. Before we came here, Eric, who's way better with computers than I did, he toted up some figures looking at all of our correspondence over how many years?
Over 10 years, I think I'm missing the first, like, year.
Okay. Big data.
He went through all of our emails together back and forth, each pretty much about the next column and what he would be drawing. Give him the figures, Eric.
Okay. So what I found were over 8,000 emails in the last 10 years. That's sort of about 800 a year. And I happened, out of curiosity, to just search the various vulgarities that Gene tends to use. And I have a list of a ton of different words that I can't use on the air, but... can I say the word that begins with I? I mean, it's not a very bad
word. Go ahead. Okay. Let's get me fired. Go ahead.
Okay. All right.
Use the word.
277 instances of the word idiot, 281 stupid, 100 moron, 162 of a certain body part that won't be mentioned, 159 terrible, 12 horrible, 40 unfunny, 88 ridiculous, 30 you are wrong. And then just three, you little Jew.
Wow, all of these people who do not like what Gene Weingarten is doing. Have you ever run a database on how many times Gene has used the word poop in a column?
No, I actually didn't search for that, but in terms of the expletive, the S word, I had 200 of those.
Gene, does this make you proud of your work?
It does.
I think it should. Eric, the Post seems to be a pretty cartoonist-friendly place. We've talked with Nick Galifianakis and Carolyn Hax about their collaboration. The Post was the home of Richard Thompson's cul-de-sac. And Mike Kavner writes about cartooning and graphic novels for the paper. What is it about D.C. that fosters that kind of community for illustrators, you think?
Well, I think one of the things about D.C. is that it's obviously political, and so you have... you have a lot of things to draw about, and the fact that it's, you know, not a huge city means that a lot of the different cartoonists and people who write about the industry and deal with the industry know each other. So I emailed Nick Galifianakis and Richard Thompson and Mike Kavner just before I came on to let them know I would be on here. We all kind of know each other, and it's a very supportive group. It's not cutthroat. It's not, you know, a group of people who hate each other and stab each other's backs. It's a really great supportive community.
When you were in Montgomery Blair at 17 years old, did you envision yourself becoming a part of this community? Is that what you wanted to do?
Well, from about the time I was 17 or 18, I became obsessed with cartooning, and part of that was joining the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists. And from the very beginning with them, I found them to be a really supportive group, and they did give me a lot of optimism about my prospects in the industry, of course.
That's the voice of Eric Shansby. He is the illustrator of the children's book Me and Dog. He's also the illustrator of the Below the Beltway column, which, of course, is written by Gene Weingarten, author of the new children's book Me and Dog. He's also the columnist behind Below the Beltway and is a Pulitzer Prize-winning staff writer at The Washington Post. If you have questions or comments, parents, have you found children's books useful in helping answer your kids' tough questions or as a jumping-off point for deeper discussions? Tell us how you've used them. 800-433-8850. Gene, you write in so many different styles. You've earned two Pulitzers for features. You've got a successful humor column, comic strip. You're pretty prolific on Twitter. Do you find that variety and the different demands of each form, do you find that strengthens your work across the board?
Yeah, I think it does. It, you know, the things that I'm perhaps best known for are very, very serious stories that I write very infrequently.
That's what you win prizes for.
Yeah. You know, I wrote something about parents who accidentally leave their children to die in hot cars. Basically, if that's all I did, I would... be walking around like Raskolnikov, a melancholic. So being able to write funny kind of underwrites the rest. And also I basically feel that tragedy and comedy are all part of the same stuff, like matter and energy. You know, it's all about the anxiety of living this odd life. And you can either laugh or cry or do a little of both.
To add to your resume, you now have this children's book coming out. How did this project evolve?
I stepped on my dog's foot. We were out. My dog's name is Murphy, same as the dog in the book. We were out on a walk. I stepped on her foot. She yelped and then looked at me and apologized. And, you know, anybody who has a dog knows when a dog is apologizing, it's a very eloquent thing. You know exactly what's happening. And clearly she felt that she must have done something wrong or I would not have punished her. And I realized kind of immediately that this was a little bit of a parable or an allegory for the way some people deal with God. You know, and that I was Murphy's God at that moment, and she must have displeased me, because otherwise this terrible thing couldn't have happened.
Yep. So Murphy looked at you as if to say, God, why would you do this? Eric, what was the process for illustrating this book with different demands than the column? Was that a big shift for you?
Yeah, it was a very different process, but being able to work with Gene the whole time gave it some sort of consistency. And it unfolded over sort of two iterations. The first version of the book that we made was about, you know, 60-year-old mustachioed Gene and his plot hound. And we gave it to the publisher and they said, well, it's a great idea, but it can't be about a 60-year-old man and a dog. It has to be about a boy and a dog. And it's got to be cuter. So
Gene did not object to being dropped from the book?
I would argue that I wasn't dropped from the book. I simply became a 5-year-old boy.
I see. And that's the argument that I guess prevailed in your creative hostility during this process.
I would say there was less hostility over the book than there is over the columns. And I think, you know, even if I haven't conveyed it, I think Gene is a genius, and it was just a total pleasure to be able to draw this neat little story.
Well, Allison in Bethesda, Maryland wants to talk, but not yet about the book. Allison, before we get into the details of the book, go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Hi, Kojo, long-time listener, first-time caller. I just love your show.
Thank you.
Gene and Eric, I just wanted to say how much I love your column. It makes me laugh out loud every week, and I think it just is great how it you can be a young reader, an old reader, and it doesn't matter. It just speaks to every age group. My question was, and I'll take this off the air, just asking about how you get your inspiration, whether it's Murphy or what else really inspires you to write.
I'm going to give you an absolute honest answer. It may be a disappointing answer, but any person who has a weekly column to write will, if they're being honest, give you the same answer, and that is that the greatest muse is the pressure of a weekly deadline. It simply forces you to find something and to make it as good as you can because it's unrelenting.
The deadline is what starts everything going. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk in more detail about Me and Dog with Eric Shansby and Gene Weingarten. You can still call us at 800-433-8850. Have you got a pet who thinks you make everything from dinner to the weather happen? Tell us how you handle your pet or how your pet handles you being God. 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back. We're talking with Gene Weingarten, author of the new children's book, Me and Dog, and columnist behind the Below the Beltway column in the Washington Post. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning staff writer at the Post. He joins us in studio along with his collaborator, Eric Shansby, illustrator of Me and Dog and the Below the Beltway column. You can call us at 800-433-8850 or send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, ask a question or make a comment there, or shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. Gene, the me in the title is a kid named Sid, and Sid strikes me as a pretty self-aware little kid. Through the book, he gently questions faith, wondering if there's really anyone in charge. How do you hope that parents will use this book?
Well, really to do that, to begin a conversation with a child. One of the reasons this book was written is that if you go onto Amazon.com and you try to call up children's book and religion, there are literally tens of thousands of pages. There are books about how to explain Rosicrucianism to a six-year-old. There is nothing you cannot find, but if you call up atheism and children's book, you essentially get nothing. This book is not hectoring. It's not proselytizing. It's sort of daring to ask a question. What if there are no real presumptions of magic? And what if there's no magic in the world? What if we have what we see? What's that like? And basically, the book finds that it is totally unthreatening, that so long as we have love and care for each other, there's a kind of secular magic that is beautiful in what is real. That's what the book deals with.
You know, it's funny because as a teenager, I quote-unquote discovered Rosicrucianism and for a while was fascinated with it, so I'm glad you brought that up. Eric, some of the illustrations in the book take up entire full double-page spreads. Others are simpler with little or no background behind an image or two on a page. Which were among your favorites, both to come up with and in terms of the final product that you saw?
Well, I think I tend to be very critical about anything that I draw within about 12 hours of finishing it. So there's a short grace period, but then I almost can't bear to look at it. And I think the things in this book that I like the best are the ones where Gene has sort of Seussian sections with a lot of different fanciful rhymes. The whole book is in doggerel, no pun intended, but... But I like the ones where I got to do little basic imaginative drawings, especially of the dog.
How many times did the publisher send your drawings back?
there were a lot of sort of tweaks, and then it was relatively infrequent that entire concepts needed to be rethought, but there was a lot of back and forth on getting it sort of just right.
Eric is, I should say this because he won't say this about himself, his drawings are fabulous, but his ideas are even better. And there are many of his ideas in the drawings in this book. I just finished a column where it's going to be coming out in a few weeks, and it's about my trying to do something on a baseball diamond with real professional baseball players and failing terribly because I am basically a flabby old man. And, we just gave this to my editor, and I gave it to Eric to try to illustrate, and almost immediately he came up with an illustration that is essentially the Dodgers logo, the logo of the Dodgers, mm-hmm. Only it says the Codgers. Not many people could think of that.
That's fascinating because you do think of him as a codger, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
I do too.
Did either of you have qualms about the sort of existential questions that this raises for a young audience, or do we not give kids enough credit a lot of the time?
I think we don't give kids enough credit a lot of time, but worse, we give them ridiculous alternatives. One of the reasons that we wrote this book is sort of as an antidote to an international bestseller that's out there called Heaven is for Real, which purports to be the story of a four-year-old child who went in for major surgery and when he was unconscious, took a trip to heaven where he met Jesus and all these fanciful... And it is presented as truth, not as, a... a dream under anesthesia or not as fantasy. This is out there as truth, selling multi-millions of copies because it's creating this anodyne world that people kind of gullibly want to believe in. And I would much rather deal with the truth as an unthreatening concept, something that children can deal with and take away a positive message from.
Are you good with that, Eric?
Yeah, I'm great with it. I'm a culturally Jewish American atheist, and there was some conversation about how explicit to make the art in illustrating this, and how kind of subversive we could be. And I don't think it's subversive at all. There were some ideas that I proposed with a little bit more direct references to religion, and Gene always said, no, don't do that. It's too in your face.
That's so funny. I'm an Episcopalian, believer, atheist, agnostic, depending on what day of the week you catch me. Here is Gene in Rockville, Maryland. Gene, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Gene, I'm gonna digress. Thank you for taking my call, by the way. My question has to do with how you decide when to run a column. I remember on one Easter morning opening up my paper, looking forward to reading it because I had the day off and all that, and reading an article about eating, if I remember correctly, poop, which I wasn't quite sure was appropriate for Easter. I realized that there's humor in it, but I thought, when do you think that's over the line, frankly?
Okay, I'm going to give you as honest an answer as I can. I think that what you're talking about is a column that I wrote interviewing a doctor who had developed a cure for an intestinal disease that involved essentially a poop transplant. You had to ingest the poop of a healthy person. Is that the column you're talking about?
I believe so, which in a sense is a column about eating poop on Easter.
Yes,
right?
Yes. I'm not questioning your...
laughing, Eric. Go ahead, PG.
I do not recall that this came out on Easter, but I'm going to accept your word that it did, and I'm going to try to explain how this happened. It probably happened because my humor columns are written 3 to 4 weeks in advance, and nobody stopped to even think that this particular Sunday would be Easter Sunday. And I think had we, again, I'm presuming you're right that it was on Easter, and probably had somebody in the process said, wait a minute, we probably would not have run it that day.
Hey, Eric, Gene, thank you very much for your call. Eric, to what extent does the editor that Gene refers to as Tom the Butcher play a role in your collaboration?
Well, he has a role similar to Gene in that he is a sort of like smart but vulgar old man. And
I hate to hear how you're going to describe me after this.
No. They're the exact opposite of you, Kocho. No, I am exaggerating that aspect. But Tom and Gene go way, way back. So they're like best buds, and they're usually on the same side of everything. So if there's a disagreement, it's usually between me and Tom and Gene. So that's kind of how it works.
Gene, as he said way back, I remember you were an editor of the Miami Herald, where you worked with now Washington Post writer Mark Fisher.
Yep.
Also worked with Dave Barry when he was there. Were you writing humor at that point in your life?
I was doing something more important in terms of developing as a humor writer. I was editing humor. And what that it's a very valuable thing to do because it teaches you to think analytically about humor. You're not just reading it and enjoying it or not enjoying it, but you're constantly put in a position of thinking, how could this be funnier? How can we set this up better? It makes you kind of a mechanic for humor. And later, when you're writing it yourself, it's a tremendous tool. I had the greatest teacher imaginable in Dave Barry.
So can we look forward to humorous Tom the Butcher in future years after years of editing your column?
He's pretty funny, but I wouldn't urge him to do that because then he would become a competitor of mine and I'd have to kill him.
On to Matt in Silver Spring, Maryland. Matt, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I think it's so amazing, Gene and Eric, that you guys are creating this, or have created this book. I'm excited to go read it. Just because I think, like you mentioned before, parents who are Zoroastrian or parents who are Jewish or parents who are Catholic, they have all these sort of outlets that they can use as a way of explaining their belief systems. And those of us who are secularists, humanists, atheists, it's a little bit harder to, you know, explain to a child, like, why we believe or don't believe the way that we do. I just think that's really great.
It's harder for us because, you know, you don't fall back on mythology, which is very easy to explain. The truth is a little more complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, another point that I was mentioning is when I was a school teacher, one of the things that we were always remembering to tell the kids is problem solve, critically think, use your logic, use the evidence, except for this one sort of glaring lie that, you know, we tell kids, which is like, don't question God, don't question religion. And so I think it's highly appropriate to at whatever the youngest possible age, make your kids free thinkers and critical thinkers.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. You seem to be suggesting, Matt, that this book might be a way to help kids do that. Oh, Matt has left the building.
I think he was suggesting that. I would also say that he touched on something very interesting that I like to talk about, which is if you look at civilization and try to define what it is, probably the single most riveting and obvious thing is that over the millennia, civilization has been the gradual dismantling of the presumptions of magic. You know, when very, very early on, everything was magic. The sun was pulled by a chariot across the skies, and, you know, diseases could be explained by a gnome dwelling in your spleen. And gradually, piece by piece, over the millennia, we have been removing all magic. Some of it took a long time to get rid of. You know, the divine right of kings took a very long time, but eventually that went. There's only one big thing left. And it's going to be hard to take down, but it will eventually go.
Gene, you dedicated the book to your plot hound, Murphy, who will be familiar to readers of your column. But, Eric, it's my understanding you had a bit of a, well, crisis of conscience in deciding on your dedication. Who's Marmalade?
Well, Marmalade is my now deceased cat, the only pet that I ever had. And I love Marmalade very much, but there was sort of a dilemma that I was faced with when choosing a dedication. The publisher said, Eric and Gene, you each get to pick a dedication, send it back, and immediately Gene said, okay, I'm dedicating it to my dog, Murphy. And so I had to figure out who to dedicate my dedication to, and the obvious choice for me was my grandmother.
Yes.
Who the Yiddish word for grandma is Bubby. And so I was sort of concerned that having a double dedication first to Murphy and then to Bubby would make it appear as though I might be dedicating the book to a sort of pet with a cute name. And
you didn't want your grandmother to be confused with the pet.
I didn't want my grandmother to be confused with a pet. And then for people who knew what a Bubby is, I didn't want them to think that I was creating some sort of
equivalence
between a plot hound and a family matriarch. And so ultimately I went with Marmalade and I don't know. I don't know how I'll be remembered in history as a boy who betrayed his grandmother.
Well, hopefully there's a book in your future that
yes.
can be dedicated to Bubby. Neither of you seems likely to be resting on your laurels for long now that this book is out. What's next on your agenda, Gene?
Well, I am...
Not that you don't have enough to do with the column and the comic strip.
Yeah, I've got a column and a comic strip, and I'm also mired in a phenomenally complicated, difficult, ultimately rewarding book project. I'm working on a book about about a day that I chose at random. I had children pull numbers out of a hat to create a date in American history. The date happened to be purely by accident. December 28th, 1986 was a Sunday. And I have spent the last year and a half and will spend the next year and a half researching that day top to bottom to basically try to prove that there's no such thing as an ordinary day, that if you dig deep enough, you know, all of the drama of human existence will be there in one grain of salt. That's
December 28th, 1986, Gene White and Garson's version of Groundhog Day. He'll be researching it over and over again for quite a while. He's the author of the new children's book, Me and Dog, also the columnist behind the Below the Beltway column, and a Pulitzer Prize-winning staff writer at the Washington Post. Good to see you again, Gene.
Good to be here.
Eric Shansby is the illustrator of Me and Dog and Below the Beltway. Eric Shansby, good to meet you.
Great to meet you, Kojo.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.